We're doing the book of Shmuel, and we'll just mention that on Wednesdays, instead of Parsha, we've been learning the Magen Midovna on the Megillah, which is probably what we'll be continuing to do at least the next week or two, and after that we'll go over to learning the Haggadah, Haggadah Shel Pesach. So I leave it to you guys to learn these Parshios on your own. If you wish that we change that, let me know. If you wish to change that, we can do Parsha, but I think this is better. You'll let me know. We had learned about the terrible story of Amnon and Tamar. How Amnon made his plot, and he took Tamar forcibly, and King David heard about it, and this is the beginning of the fulfillment of the curse on David's house, the curse that was self-prescribed. And we discussed how David and his court instituted the prohibition of yichud, even with single girls, after this story, to prevent such a thing from happening again. And after 2 years, we learned how Avshalom was making a big party in honor of shearing his sheep. He invited David. David refuses. He says, if I come, you'll have to make such a big meal. I don't want to come. And Avshalom says, but at least send me your eldest son, Amnon, my eldest brother. He's next in line for the throne. And that that will at least be a representation of you. And finally, David tells Amnon, okay, you go instead. And Avshalom tells his lads, when you see Amnon has drunk a lot of wine, I'll give you the sign, and you guys kill him. And don't worry, it's my fault, I said so. And that's what they did. They give him a lot to drink, and when the time comes, they kill him. And all the other princes figure that that's it, he's probably going to kill everyone. So they all run, and they're running, and David gets word that Avshalom killed all his other sons. No one's left, and David tears his clothing, and he throws himself to the ground, and now all the servants tear their clothing. And then Yonadav, that cousin who gave Amnon that bad advice, how he'd be able to get Tamar all alone, he says, don't worry about it, not all your kids are dead. I bet it's only Amnon that's dead. That from the day Amnon raped his sister, he's wanted to kill Amnon. I bet it's only Amnon. Don't think that everyone's dead. It's only Amnon. Now Avshalom ran away. He doesn't want to get killed for killing his brother. And they look, and they'd been looking in one direction. Turns out from behind them, from the other side of the mountain, all the other sons come. And Yonadav tells the king, you see, that group of people coming must be your other sons, the way I said. And that's what happens. They all weep. And Avshalom, his mother was the beautiful daughter of Talmai, the king of Geshur. So now that he has to run away from his father, so he runs to Talmai, the king of Geshur, to hide. And he's there for 3 years. And after 3 years pass, so David has already mourned the passing of his son Amnon, and he's starting to wish to have a kesher, to have some contact with his son Avshalom. And his nephew Yoav, the son of his sister Tzeruiah, his chief general, realizes that deep down inside, David wants to reconcile with Avshalom. And so Yoav has to summon a wise woman. He sends to the city of Tekoa. Chazal tells us Tekoa ilfa l'shemin. Tekoa was the first choice when you wanted to get good oil, and that's why the people of Tekoa were exceptionally wise. The Talmud says olive oil makes a person smart. So you guys, if you want to be naturalists, put in your salads olive oil. The Talmud says that's what makes you smart. So Yoav sends to Tekoa to get a wise woman from there. And he tells her, here's what I want you to do. Get dressed up. Make believe you've been mourning for a period. And come to the king with your hair all frazzled and your skin all parched. And make believe you've been mourning for a while. Come with tattered clothes. And tell him the following story. And so the woman comes, the way Yoav set her up, and she says, save me, the king, save me. And the king says, what's wrong? And she says, I'll tell you the truth. I'm an almana. I'm a widow. And my husband's dead. Yeah, well, I guess if you're a widow, your husband's dead. But she's telling a story. And the way women talk when they're in pain and in sorrow is they sometimes say the same thing twice, and they're insistent, and they're panicked, and they definitely reiterate the fact that their dear husband has died. So she comes and says, I'm a widow and my husband died, and you know, your mate, she's talking about herself, I have two sons, and they were fighting out in the field, and because I'm a widow, so there was no one there to get intercede, and one killed the other. And now, the family has been coming to me, saying, give over the murderer. And they want to kill him for killing his brother, but the truth is, they want to kill him so there'll be no inheritor, and they'll get all the inheritance. And then they'll put out the little bit of coal that's remained, the little bit of light that's remained, and there'll be nothing left over of my husband. Nothing left over of his name. And what's she saying? Technically, there were no witnesses. So he killed his brother. I admit he killed his brother, but halachically you can't kill him. The Torah says in order to give the death penalty, there have to be witnesses, there has to be a warning, Edim, Asra. So I'm not saying he didn't kill him. He did kill him. But halachically they can't do that. And what they're trying to do is unfair and not halachic. What's she alluding to? We know the backdrop to the scene. She's alluding to Avshalom. Yes, Avshalom killed his brother, but you can't touch him. Halachically, there were no witnesses. Ah, there were witnesses, but no one warned him. There were no Edom in Asra. Anyways, it wasn't Avshalom who did it. He told his servants to do it. You can't kill him. You can't touch him. Technically, halachically, he didn't do anything that you could kill him for. But that's all going to unravel later. So the king says, okay, go home and I'll order someone to take care of your case, to look into your case. And the woman says, but you see, I'm telling the truth. How could you not rule? If you'll rule in error, I take the responsibility for the sin. If it turns out I tricked you that some of my facts were inaccurate, I'll take the sin and you're clean. But I want you to rule on it now. Then you'll verify whether I was right or not. I can't wait and leave my son in danger. So the king says, if anyone comes to talk to you about it, you bring him to me and I'll see to it that he doesn't touch you anymore. And she says, yeah, but my master, the king... I want you to remember this because the relatives who say they're coming to avenge his death, they're going to try to convince you and don't let them get away with it. Promise me. And the king says, I promise by Hashem not a hair will fall of his head. Not a hair will fall to the ground. Okay, so he said, I'll summon someone to look into the case. He's told her, okay, I'll take your word for it. And for now we're going to rule no one can touch you. And she's insistent and finally says, I swear not a hair will fall to the ground, no one will touch him. And she says, my master, the king, can your maid say something else before you? So he says, speak. So she says, why'd you believe me? Why do you think the nation of God would do such a thing? That really, when there are no witnesses, people would be willing to kill my only remaining son? But what I really don't understand is that you promised me that not a hair would fall down, but you must have been mistaken because you have a son who's being kicked out of your palace for an identical case, and you know what? At the end of the day, we all die. So Amnon died. Okay, you know what? Everyone dies at some point. And once a person's dead, it's like you spilled water on the earth. The water gets absorbed. You can't recollect it. You're not going to bring Amnon back by punishing Avshalom. And the one who's supposed to run cases like this is God. God is the one who takes care of cases where halachically we can't touch a murderer. And then don't worry, no one's getting away. And it could be that God over here was paying back Amnon for the evil that Amnon did. But we can't interfere here. Halachically we have no right. And now I came to you, my master the king, she says, now she's got to finish her story, how is she going to end her speech? She says, I've said all of this because I was worried that if I come straight away, you'll get all upset at me. How am I going to come and tell you, who am I to advise the king, what to do with your own son? So I had to do it in a roundabout way. Everyone scared me off. They wouldn't be willing to listen if I didn't come like this. I said, let me give you advice, but I have no rights. I figured I'll say it like this. I figured just as you're willing to listen to me to save my life and to save my son's life from the relatives, so then you'll be able to take your own advice and help yourself. You're an angel of God, and I know that you're willing to hear the truth, and Hashem is with you. And the king says, okay, but don't lie to me. Tell me everything I'm going to ask you now. And she says, okay, what do you say? She says, is Yoav the one that put you up to all of this? So he saw through the whole smoke screen. He saw the whole story. So she says, I swear that you can't go right or left from everything you say. You're so smart. And yes, he told me to come to you. And he told me this whole allegory to tell you. Because he wanted you to be convinced. If he would come straight away, you wouldn't see the truth like this. It came through me, and you were able to see how you ruled in a similar case. And you're so smart to figure everything out. I didn't even say it, and you figured it out. And the king calls in Yoav and says, okay, you set me up, fine. Now you go and bring Avshalom back. And Yoav bows before him and blesses him and says, now I know that you love me. Even when I do a trick on you, I find favor in your eyes. And Yoav goes to Geshur to bring back Avshalom. And David sends word, send him home, I don't want to see him. He's welcome back, but I don't want to see him. And Avshalom goes home and he doesn't see David. Now Avshalom was the most beautiful person in Israel. And every year he'd shave his head and sell his hair for 200 coins. It seems he was a Nazir. And Avshalom had three sons and a daughter whose name was Tamar, and she was also very beautiful. And Avshalom stays in Jerusalem for 2 years, and the king won't see him for 2 years. So he tries to send word to Yoav, get me in to see the king. And Yoav doesn't want to come. He sends a second message. Yoav doesn't want to come. So Avshalom tells his servants, look over there. Yoav has a bunch of barley. Go burn it. So they burn Yoav's barley. And Yoav comes storming to Avshalom's house. And he says, why'd your servants burn my lot? So Avshalom says, well, I sent word to you to come. You wouldn't come talk to me. So I want you to go tell the king, what did I come back from Geshur? I might as well have stayed there. You're not willing to see me. If you feel that I deserve to be killed, kill me. But what are you bringing me back and doing it halfway? You're not even willing to talk to me. So Yoav tells the king, and he summons Avshalom. He bows before David, and David kisses Avshalom. And at first glance, everything is okay. And the commentaries say not at all. Vayishak HaMelech LeAvshalom. The Malbim points out over here, based on the Ibn Ezra and Bereshis, that when it comes to kissing, there were different norms in the days of the Tanakh. In the days of the Tanakh, there were two types of kisses. Even men would kiss mouth to mouth, and that was an indication of love. And any other kiss on any other part of the body, on the hand, on the cheek, was an indication of distance. And when it says, Vayishak li, with the lamed, Vayishak li Avshalom, it means he kissed his hand, or something like that, and it was a sign, don't get too close. I'm willing to see you, but things aren't over.
The other kind is
So, Avshalom, after this story, his father, to his mind, has forgiven him. He's back in good terms, and he makes for himself this huge chariot with 50 people running before him. And Avshalom would get up early in the morning every day and stand at the gates, and every person that would come to David to be judged. So after the judgment, Avshalom would ask him, hey pal, where are you from? And he'd be a real politician. And Avshalom would start promising everyone, you know, you got such a good case, and the king doesn't even listen to you. If I were a judge, and everyone would come to me, I'd make you all right. You'd all win. You understand? That's only a politician can do. You promise both sides, you give them what they want. It's an impossibility. But that doesn't matter when you don't have to put your money where your mouth is. You can make promises. And then the person would come and bow. He's standing before the prince, it seems like he was next in line. The guy would come to bow, and Avshalom would hold on to him, and he'd kiss him and send him off and say, "Don't bother." So Avshalom, the pasuk says, stole the heart of the Jewish people. He was talking in a deceitful way, and he knew how to draw the people out from under David to be loyal to him. Every person he'd talk in a personable way, and this was what he'd spend his mornings doing. Every day he'd be waiting there for all the top cases to come to David, and he'd keep telling them, "Believe me, if I were judge, you'd be right. You have a case." And notice how he first asks him where you're from, gets to know him. Now he's won a friend, one after another. But you know what? Slowly word starts spreading. The king has a son who really, he's on my side. The king didn't give me what I wanted, but the king's son, he really knows a thing or two. It's been 40 years since the Jews asked for a king. It is towards the end of David's life, and Avshalom tells David, "I want to go and pay off my vow that I promised Hashem in Hebron. I promised that I would bring to Hebron a sacrifice. When I was out in Geshur, when I was chased away, I said, if Hashem sends me back to Jerusalem, if Hashem allows me to come back, I'll bring a sacrifice." And they had a big bama in Hebron, and the king says, "Go in peace." So he goes, and David says, "Lech bi shalom." Chazal say he told him, "Lech bi shalom," and he didn't end up coming back alive, as we will see. So Avshalom, we have a tradition that a whole long story happened here. Avshalom came to David and says, "I want to take two sages from the top court." And David says, "Who?" He says, "I don't know yet." He says, "Write me a letter that says that the two who I show this to should come with me to Hebron." So David agrees, he writes a letter, signs it with his ring, that says the two rabbis from the chief court, from the high court, who Avshalom shows us to, should go with him to Hebron. So he goes to two of the rabbis of the high court, and he shows it to them, and they come with him. They start traveling, he goes to the next two and brings them with him. And slowly but surely, like this, he gets all of the rabbis of the high court to come with him, and they're unwitting. They don't realize that he's about to stage a rebellion. They don't know. David said to go. They go. Fine, what are they going to say? Avshalom sends out spies throughout Israel, and he says, "When you hear the trumpet blow, you declare Avshalom's been anointed in Hebron." And Avshalom goes with him. 200 people are with him. He has 200 nobles. They don't even know what's happening. But it's going to look really big. All these nobles are there. The high court is there. And then some of his friends are going to proclaim him king. And Avshalom takes with him Achitophel. Now, Achitophel was the grandfather of David's wife. Which wife? Bathsheba. Bathsheba. And ever since David killed Bathsheba's first husband, who was that? Uriah Achiti. Achitophel wants him dead. And Achitophel is the smartest man on the planet. He is so smart. The Navi says about him something it doesn't say anywhere else. It says that asking him was like asking God for advice. Brilliant man. Very young, in his early 30s. Already a grandfather. He married young, his son married young. Bathsheba was very young. And Achitophel is advising Avshalom how to get his rebellion underway. And the whole nation has heard that Avshalom is now king, and they join the rebellion. And David gets word that most of Israel is with Avshalom. The people of Israel have turned against him. And David has a situation where his major threat is what's going to be with the few people that are with him in his palace. What's going to be now? Avshalom seems to have done everything without his being prepared for it. And David realizes that Avshalom is advancing towards the castle, and he might want to kill him. And now David has to figure out how to get his people on his side. We have a tradition that more things happen at this point. David broke out in leprosy. He got tzaraas. No one could walk within 4 footsteps of David. David is in pain. His own son is trying to kill him. God isn't talking to him. And David sees everything he built crumbling before his eyes. No one can walk within 4 footsteps of him. He's like a menudeh, like someone that's ostracized. And the question now is, are people going to side with him? And should they side with him? And how could he get them to side with him? And we'll pick up here, Bezalel Hashem, next week.